What has been accomplished in the past 24 hours has been very significant in reducing the volume of oil at Drift River Terminal and the associated risk to the environment.
Chevron stops producing Cook Inlet oil. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 6th of April. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Senator Mark Begich calls for funds to complete the missile defense system.
North Korea has once again shown us why it's important that Alaska is part of this equation, the missile defense system.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Association of Alaska School Boards. Parents that read to their children foster early learning and educational development for children and youth. Information at aasb.org.
Chevron has halted its oil production in Cook Inlet because of continuing threats from the Mount Redoubt eruption. The company stores its oil at the Drift River Terminal, about 22 miles from the volcano. Overnight, nearly 4 million gallons of oil were removed from the terminal and transferred to the tanker Seabulk Arctic. More than 2 million gallons still remain in two tanks at the site. They have been backfilled with water to make them more stable in case they are pushed loose by a flood caused by a volcanic explosion. Gary Folley is with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
The top priorities from the beginning have been the safety of the workers at the terminal, preventing a spill, and protecting the environment by minimizing the amount of oil at the terminal.
The unified command overseeing the response to the Drift River situation had been planning to try to keep oil flowing through the facility, but Folley says they decided that was too dangerous an option. Cook Inlet Pipeline Company, which operates the Drift River facility, is planning to evacuate all 11 workers still on site. Chevron says the oil production lost amounts to more than 7,000 barrels a day. That oil would normally end up at the Tesoro refinery in Nikiski, where it is turned into gasoline, jet fuel, heating oil, and diesel. Chevron says it doesn't know yet how many jobs will be affected, but Gary Folley with DEC says the state recognizes it will be a significant impact.
Myself, I'm a resident of Soldotna, and I can tell you that many folks in Kenai and Soldotna and on the peninsula have relatives, neighbors, and friends who earn their livelihoods in the oil industry. So for us, this is a very critical issue.
The environmental group Cook Inlet Keeper has been closely watching the potential impact of a flood at the Drift River Terminal. Executive Director Bob Shavelson says he is glad the Unified Command decided to backfill the tanks with water to prevent them from floating away. But he says the amount of oil still on site represents a huge threat to Cook Inlet.
When you look at spill response equipment, what we have in the way of skimmers and suckers and mopping tools, and then you compare that to the force and the violence and the chaos produced from a lahar and a volcano, we don't have the spill response technology to address a catastrophic spill in those circumstances.
Both Chevron and Cook Inlet Pipeline Company say they don't know when they'll be able to ramp up oil production again. The volcano will have to settle down first, but it is still sputtering. The last big explosion happened Saturday morning. Since then, scientists think it's been building a new dome. They've seen viscous lava oozing out of the crater, and geologist Margaret Mangoon says the volcano's monitors are recording frequent drumbeat earthquakes.
In layman terms, you might think of them as think of the volcano as a little steam engine. It's pushing out lava as well as gas, and each one of those drum beats is the resonance or the puff of the steam engine. That is a sign that the eruption continues and is still in a state where further explosive activity could occur with little or no warning.
Mangoon says the volcano may eventually enter a more predictable phase where explosive events will be easier to forecast. The judge, who presided over the trial of former Senator Ted Stevens, is continuing his push for information from the Justice Department, even as the government seeks to dismiss the case. Judge Emmett Sullivan filed orders yesterday that indicate he may want to pursue what went wrong at the Department of Justice. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Judge Sullivan will hold a hearing tomorrow morning on the government's motion to throw out Ted Stevens' guilty verdict and dismiss the indictment. Sullivan is expected to do just that, putting an end to the case. But even if Stevens walks away a free man, the Justice Department may not be off the hook in Judge Sullivan's courtroom. He filed two orders yesterday. One directs the department, the FBI, the IRS, and any other government agencies involved in the case to preserve all documents and information, including emails, notes, audio recordings, and electronic files. They are not allowed to destroy anything relating to the case. Sullivan also ordered that all evidence about an FBI whistleblower complaint be given to the court. Federal prosecutors had until this morning to turn over all the materials gathered after the trial that they gave to Stevens' lawyers. And the judge ordered the government to provide attorney notes from an interview they did last year with their star witness, former Vico CEO Bill Allen. The year-old notes were found by a new prosecution team 2 weeks ago and had not been turned over to Stevens' lawyers before the trial. In them, Allen contradicts testimony he gave on the witness stand. The lapse was the latest in a string of problems by the Justice Department and caused Attorney General Eric Holder to seek dismissal of all charges against Stevens. The former senator was convicted last fall of lying on financial disclosure forms, but Holder wants the verdict thrown out. Even as Judge Sullivan acts on that, he may want to keep jurisdiction over the Justice Department's errors, who was at fault, and why. The judge grew increasingly frustrated with the prosecution during and after the trial. In February, Judge Sullivan held three government lawyers in contempt for failing to turn over documents to the defense, and he railed at the prosecution team during the trial when they withheld information from Stevens' lawyers. Soon after the trial, an FBI agent wrote a letter to the court alleging misconduct by prosecutors and a fellow agent. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Freshman Senator Mark Begich is in Alaska this week on break from Washington congressional duties. Begich told reporters today that he'll be talking to Governor Palin and state legislatures on Tuesday about the stimulus bill and how dollars will flow into Alaska. Palin has yet to agree to accept all provisions of the stimulus package for Alaska. Begich says yesterday's North Korean missile launch has put the spotlight back on Alaska's strategic position in national security. He says the state's congressional delegation is united in pushing for re-inclusion of money in the national defense budget for completion of missile testing and facilities. Secretary Robert Gates has released a budget excluding funds for completion of missile defense systems nationwide.
We're going to fight hard over the next several months to try to put that money back in. The good news is it's not reducing down what we have, so it's at what we have today. And what we wanted to make sure and want to make sure is the additional third is put back into the final third. So in one way, we've been spared to a certain extent. But the reality is this is not a time to stabilize or stop funding the expansion of the program. North Korea has once again shown us why it's important that Alaska is part of this equation, the missile defense system.
Long-range missiles from North Korea could reach Alaska and Hawaii, Begich says, making an Alaska missile defense system more important than ever. On his part, Begich is fielding some political missiles headed his way in response to a request by certain Alaska Republicans to step down from his Senate seat in light of the U.S. Justice Department's abandonment of the case against former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens. Begich made his position clear.
I recognize that Randy Rudrick and Sarah Palin have other political agendas, and whatever that might be, mine is focused on what Alaska's agenda is, and that's getting these critical issues resolved.
He says some vital issues facing the state and the nation are energy independence, health care, education, and deficit reduction. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a public health checkup for the state.
You know, it seems like we've accepted Homer Simpson as the norm. Next stop is the characters in WALL-E.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
The legislature is continuing its study of the elements of a long and short-term plan for the state's energy needs. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Conserving energy is the best and quickest way to save money and resources for fuel. And the House Energy Committee was told Saturday that it should be the first step in any energy plan the state develops. The panel hosted a roundtable discussion with 9 experts in different areas of energy demand and supply as a roundup of the hearings it's been holding all session. John Davies with the Cold Climate Housing Research Center says Alaska should use its wealth to provide sustainability. It should not continue to be dependent on fossil fuels.
To start with, we have to reduce the demand for energy and the demand for transportation resources and all across the board. So figure out ways to reduce the demand and where we have to provide that more efficiently.
Beyond that, the panelists recommend renewable energy sources, local supplies of manufactured goods and food, and according to Mira Kohler with the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, the state should begin to plan beyond local needs and local utilities.
We search in vain for local solutions. There may not be good local solutions because our populations are so small in these local areas. I believe we should be looking for the best solutions for the entire state. That would mean building the projects that deliver the maximum benefits for the investment, but sharing those benefits across the state through another mechanism.
She said the current electrical distribution system, with many local electric generation points, only helps create a politics of separation, where communities have to fight with each other for a portion of the small resources available. There was also support for better communications and coordination in new construction, especially in the architectural and design of new projects the legislature funds through its capital budget. George Kanellis, the federal co-chair of the Denali Commission, called for a state energy standard for publicly owned buildings and honest talk about design and operating needs.
There's examples where it's happening and examples where it's not. Fort Yukon is an interesting example where the Denali Commission recently opened a sub-regional clinic. Other agencies are improving water and sewer, doing road improvements, doing airport improvements, doing housing improvements. And then the mayor raised his hand and said, oh, we don't have the generating capacity. How does that happen in this day and age? It shouldn't.
The committee's already arranging 9 more meetings around the state during the interim on improving Alaska's approach to energy. The panelists' input will be a part of the findings. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
As a result of the weekend meeting, the Energy Committee today introduced a bill that would create a new cabinet-level Department of Energy. Committee co-chair Cherise Millett said the goal is to streamline energy programs by putting them all in one place.
One of the things that we heard just throughout rural Alaska is that rural Alaskans are the users of most of these programs, a lot of the revolving loan funds, the bridge funds, the weatherization funds, and they're disenfranchised with having to call several different departments to find help. So our goal is to have a one-stop shop for energy, and also the legislation enables this department to accept all federal monies.
Millett says the committee will meet during the interim on what she calls a policy summit in communities across the state. The plan is to come up with a consolidation of various local ideas.
We understand, and what we've heard throughout our travels and through our committee meeting process, is we do have a state energy plan. It's just everywhere. Every community has one. Every Native corporation has one. Southeast Conference has one. Swampsea has one. Tri-Borough has one. So the work is out there, and what we aim to do this interim is to gather all those policies and review them all and incorporate those components that make sense for the state as an overriding statewide policy into our first steps at a statewide policy and a statewide energy plan.
Millett said committee leaders met with the governor late Saturday and said the governor is cautiously enthusiastic about the plan. Tomorrow, Anchorage holds its municipal elections. As KSKA's Len Anderson reports, there are an unprecedented number of candidates.
The abundance of mayoral candidates this spring has produced something of an identification quandary for Anchorage voters, to say nothing of a selection dilemma. 15 names appear in the mayor portion of the ballot. Their very numbers has caused candidate forum organizers and much of the media to concentrate on the designated top six. Those include the acting mayor, a three-term former assembly member, a current assembly member, a former state legislator, the former Anchorage chief of police and state public safety commissioner, and the former Anchorage Police Department communications director and spokesman. The question, almost as large as who will get the most votes, is, will he or she get enough votes to win the mayor's office outright? Anchorage Municipal Charter demands 45% plus one vote to avoid a runoff. If no such victor emerges tomorrow, Anchorage voters will be asked to decide between the two biggest vote-getters on May 5th. The four school board races attracted 23 candidates, with most clustered in the races for the two open seats. One of them has 13 candidates and the other 7, but one has withdrawn. The third seat features a contest between a two-term incumbent and a political newcomer, and the fourth, perhaps much to the voters' relief, is an unopposed incumbent. And then there are the major propositions on the ballot, 9 of them. The first 8 are for a total of approximately $150 million in general obligation bonds to be paid by property taxes. The 9th proposition is a reaction to Anchorage's rising property taxes in recent years. It focuses on revenues raised under the city's 25-year-old tax cap. 6 years ago, the Assembly, urged by then-Mayor Mark Begich, voted unanimously to remove city utilities and enterprises from tax cap calculations. A successful initiative has brought the question of reinstating them under the tax cap to the ballot. Backers say, if approved, property taxes would fall. Opponents say, given the wording and the outcome of a pending lawsuit, they just might rise. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Comfort Suites Anchorage International Airport. Comfort Suites, an all-suites hotel, is now open with a 24-hour shuttle service, indoor pool, and high-speed internet access. Reservations at 243-8080.
Alaskans are getting older and fatter, and that's worrying state health officials. To mark National Public Health Week, we called Dr. Jay Butler, Chief Medical Officer with the Department of Social Services, for a checkup on where Alaskans stand on the national health scale. He says there are 3 big emerging public health challenges in Alaska.
One is the obesity epidemic, and that translates into higher rates of heart disease, higher rates of diabetes, and even certain types of cancer have been associated with obesity. The second big challenge is the aging of the population. And the problems associated with aging are really going to impact the public health system as well as the healthcare system. And then the third threat is the ongoing challenge of infectious diseases. We have this way of thinking that infectious diseases are somehow conquered, yet new ones always come up. And if we look at what are the infectious disease challenges today, a lot of them are things that we didn't even know existed 30 years ago. HIV/AIDS is a good example. We've certainly seen new diseases that have threatened to come to Alaska, such as SARS, which we were very fortunate that that didn't happen. But the infectious diseases will not just go away, and they certainly teach us the lesson that if we let down our guard at any time, we are at risk.
Are there any particular maladies that are rampant in Alaska that are not seen as much in other places?
The problems that we're dealing with are very similar to other parts of the country. The obesity, so-called epidemic, is something that's occurring all across the country. And that means that Alaska is not going to get any special treatment in terms of federal support for addressing this problem.
How about our state legislature? Are they providing adequate funds in your view?
Well, this has certainly been a time of economic tightening all across the board. And the governor's budget included addressing some of the challenges in public health, such as the obesity epidemic. That didn't do very well in the legislature, and I hope that we'll continue to be able to work with the legislature to recognize that we are spending huge amounts of money on treatment of chronic diseases, yet we're doing very little to prevent them. And it's just not fiscally conservative, it's not physically sound to approach public health in this way.
My next question is about the economic downturn. Is this going to affect health? I mean, we're seeing a lot of more psychological stress now, right?
The economic downturn is going to impact health in a number of ways. With less disposable income, people may be more likely to choose less healthy foods. It's not impossible to eat more healthy on a budget, but it does become a little harder. If we look over the past 25 years, sugar-sweetened beverages, for instance, have actually declined in relative cost, whereas fruits and vegetables have increased in cost by more than 50%. So we could actually see the obesity epidemic worsening as the economy declines. And in fact, that fits with the fact that, in general, obesity rates are higher among people of low socioeconomic status. We could also see certainly stress-related diseases. As people fret over their situation, they may be more prone to stress-related diseases. And also, they may be less likely to take care of themselves. It may be tougher if you're working two jobs to spend some time to get a little exercise and also to unwind a little bit during the course of the day.
How does Alaska stack up with the rest of the nation?
Well, we're kind of middle of the pack when we compare ourselves to other states. And it depends a little bit on what the measure is. For some of the sexually transmitted diseases, we're actually right there at the top of the list. Tuberculosis, we are also very high among the states. In other measures, we do fairly well. In fact, one of the questions I oftentimes get is, are we the most obese state? And again, we're sort of middle of the pack. We're not the most obese. But boy, talk about grading on the curve. The whole country is way too heavy. So that's not one that I can take a lot of comfort in terms of considering the health of Alaskans.
Dr. Jay Butler is Alaska's chief medical officer. Anchorage is the only community in Alaska with its own public health and human services division. Diane Engel directs the department. She says one challenge she faces is convincing residents that public health makes as big a difference in their daily lives as do public schools or libraries. She says her department is largely invisible when they are doing their job well, and they're responsible for a broad spectrum of services.
Inspecting restaurants so people don't get sick when they go out to eat, immunizing children and some adults against preventable diseases, educating the public about how not to get disease, working on global public health or larger public health issues like enforcing smoking policies and helping to turn the curve on obesity, domestic violence, sexual assault, just to name a few.
Engel says, in general, Anchorage is a healthy place to live, but there's always room for improvement. She says the United Way is seeking an increased demand for homeless services. The average age of a homeless person in the city is 9 years old.
So certainly there's a lot of concern around families. Kids don't have a place to live, or families who are couch surfing. That just impacts your ability to be healthy. It impacts your ability to get an education, to be stable in your work. So certainly all of education, income, and health are just so incredibly linked.
The Anchorage Department of Public Health is also currently paying close attention to the Mount Redoubt eruption. They are responsible for monitoring air quality when the volcano sends ash over the municipality. The Alaska National Guard has created a yellow ribbon program to acquaint Guard members and their families with the array of services available to those who've served their state and country. KNOM's Paul Korshin has more.
Outreach advocates from several organizations came to Nome last week to inform soldiers about their options. Employee Support of Guard and Reserve Program Director Chris Nelson said it marks the start of an extended effort to connect.
Reaching out to them and keeping in good communications with them is an ongoing challenge. This is the very first time this team has come out, and all summer long we're going to be working. Our goal is to try to get into every village where there's an armory and talk directly to our service members and to our veterans about their rights, about their responsibilities, and about the benefits that they're entitled to that they may have been missing because they're out here in an area that really doesn't fit with the rest of the United States.
Nelson said returning Guard members have legal rights to regain their civilian jobs, but larger trends can complicate things.
We're concerned about reemployment in a troubled economy. A lot of businesses are going under or are downsizing while their employees are serving. And we work with them to let them know what they're entitled to. We work with the employers. And I've got to say, here in Alaska, we have outstanding support from employers.
Myrta Adams is the Guard's transition assistance advisor and says post-traumatic stress disorder among rural Guard members is merely one of the challenges they're working to treat.
Some people are needing PTSD behavioral health care that is not available to them locally. There are programs out there they're not aware of. There's telephonic counseling, there's online counseling through Military OneSource and other services.
Soldiers in remote communities who want help can face numerous hurdles.
For behavioral health, for example, the stigma of you're seeing a psychologist, you're seeing a psychiatrist, we serve together, I'm not having problems, but you are, there must be something wrong with you. That's one of the biggest stigma. The second one is that a lot of them have injuries, and because they don't know where to receive the care for it or how to pay for the trip to get down to Anchorage to receive the care, they turn to other means such as drug and alcohol abuse and to hide those pains and to hide the suffering.
World War II veteran Dan Carman of Nome and Deering says he witnessed some of the difficulties for returning Korean War soldiers firsthand.
And when they came back, there was this one young man that was all patched up, sewed up, was hurting so badly he started drinking to keep the pain down. And we never did know after getting discharged from the military where we could get help. The distance from Anchorage or Fairbanks, where there was more reasonable service for veterans, but not out here in the bush.
Carmen says rural Alaskans have always been well suited to military life in some respects. But in other regards, bush soldiers have been on their own. So Carmen says he's pleased the Yellow Ribbon program has come along.
I know our elders prayed for us, helped us to try and overcome. But that's something I'm glad that the National Guard here is beginning to have that reach out. If there's a war to fight out, to have peace, then there's a chance that our young people will be called on.
Alaska National Guard Yellow Ribbon representatives expect to continue traveling to bush communities well into 2010. In Nome, I'm Paul Korchin.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage and Paul Korchin in Nome. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.